live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Red Sox beat the Dodgers 4-2 last night, and they take a 2-0 series lead. Stop me if you've heard this one before, but they scored all four of their runs with two men out, and they continue to be absolutely clutch as hell. I said it last night on Twitter. The Dodgers flat out cannot get out of an inning. And while the Red Sox cash in nearly every one of their opportunities, the Dodgers are not cashing in any of theirs. That's the difference so far in the series. The Red Sox making all the clutch plays, all the clutch pitches, getting all the clutch knocks, and the Dodgers pretty much are doing none of that. Remember, I posed the question before the series started. Does LA's best beat Boston's best? We'll never know because the Sox are not getting the Dodgers' best. Not their best play, and certainly not their best bats. Because Dave Roberts and the Dodgers front office are sticking with what got them here, the matchups. That's fine. It did work in the regular season. That's fine. It worked against the Brewers in the postseason. Except one thing. This is not the regular season. It's the World Series. These are not the Brewers. They're arguably the best Red Sox team ever. Arguably one of the best baseball teams ever. You see, the Red Sox answer the bell. The Dodgers are not. Alleged postseason pinata, David Price, nails again. I mean, from a guy who allegedly couldn't get it done in the postseason to Boston's horse, Boston's ace. That said, while he was pitching a no-hitter through three innings, the Dodgers got to him in the fourth. David Freese, single. Manny Machado, single. Chris Taylor, walk. Bases loaded, nobody out. The Dodgers had something working. Now it's time to blow this thing open. Rip the home field, and then we've got a totally different series going back to L.A. Matt Kemp gets a sac fly. That ties the game at one. Kike Hernandez strikes out. Yasiel Puig singles. And then David Price gets Austin Barnes. In the end, the Dodgers led 2-1, but that was another blown opportunity. Maybe even a blown series, because they had a chance to blow that thing wide open, and they couldn't do it. Dave Roberts said it best. You get Price on the ropes. The guy's taking punishment. He's not defending himself. The ref is leaning in. He's taking a long look. Except Price was able to weather the storm. They could not finish him, and he survives the round. Gets back to his stool, gets a minute, gets a second breath, and then that's that. In a series like that, if you've got a guy on the ropes, you've got to knock him the hell out. The Dodgers couldn't do it. So, you may hate the Red Sox. You may hate the Red Sox fans. You may hate both. But you've got to respect how freaking tough their 25 are. And if you don't choke them out when you can, they're going to take you out. And they did. Bottom of the fifth, Ian Kinsler ground out. Jackie Bradley Jr. pop out. And then with two outs, they go to work. It's almost like they looked up at the scoreboard. They saw the two outs. They tasted their own blood. Cracked their own knuckles and said, let's do this. Let's go. So they load the bases. Dave Roberts goes to Ryan Matson. Ryan Matson goes arsonist. He committed the cardinal sin of any reliever. He walked the first batter, and he did it with the bases loaded to tie that game up. And then it only went from bad to worse. And that's the problem when you face this Red Sox lineup. There's always an MVP or an all-star or some clutch hitter digging into the batter's box. And the last guy you want to see in that situation is the guy they did see, J.D. Martinez.
Runners lead at first, second, and third. A 1-0 pitch to J.D. Here it is. Swinging a looper to right field. Sinking fast. It gets down for a base hit. Mookie scores. Here comes Benny. He scores too. On to third. Pierce. 4-2 Red Sox.
4-2 Red Sox in the fifth. Ball game. Thanks for coming. See you back in L.A. And you Chows may as well give us our love right now because you may not see another game back here. It might not make it back. Yeah, I know it's only one game. Yes, I know it's only Boston handling their business at home. And it's not an actual series until somebody loses at home. I know all that. Let me tell you something else I know. None of that crap applies in this series because that was way more than one game. Or a team protecting the home field. Teams that go up 2-0 in the World Series win more than 80% of the time. Furthermore, most of the teams that we're talking about in that 80% are not the Red Sox. So go ahead and bump that 80% even higher, much higher. Because through two games, the Red Sox are just a better team. And even though they're coming back home, I don't think the Dodgers, frankly, or anybody else for that matter, are going to beat these Red Sox four times in five games. And if Boston ends up going right through L.A., the way they went right through Houston, the way they went right through the Yankees, get ready to have that conversation about where you slot this team historically. Because if they finish this thing as quickly as it appears they might, there is no question, they're not only the best Red Sox team ever, they're one of the best teams ever. Bobby Flay. Bobby, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Bobby, it's great to have you. Listen, first things first, let me get this out of the way. I know you waited a long time for the Knicks to get their act together. In fact, you're still waiting. They win their season opener. They drop four in a row. How you feeling, Bobby, about the team right now?
Oh, God. Every season brings hope. And so I haven't given up hope yet. We're five games into it. I need to get to a game to rally these boys.
All right, so Knicks aside, Bobby. Knicks aside, I know you'll get there to rally them up. That aside, how is life for you right now?
Life is great. I have to say, restaurant business is fun and vibrant, and Beat Bobby Flay Food Network is going well. I have to have you on the show. And, you know, that's right up your alley. We'll have to make sure that happens.
Wait, Bobby, so we're talking about me cooking against you? Is that what you mean?
No.
Good.
No. On Beat Bobby Flay, basically, I bring my friends on who sort of they curate a chef to come on and get me beat. It's kind of like, you know, like when guys are hanging around watching sports and they give each other a hard time. This is basically the same thing, except it just involves cooking.
Okay. That I can handle. That I would do. I'd love to take you up on that. Good. Bobby Flay is my guest. All right. So the other thing right now, Bobby, we're about 8 days off of the Breeders' Cup, which is next weekend at Churchill Downs. When you get to this time of year, how often do you find yourself thinking back to 2010 and that amazing run that you got from More Than Real in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Phillies Turf?
Yeah, that was amazing. Listen, I know you know this. You know that feeling a couple of times. So you're one up on me for sure. It's a great feeling. The Breeders' Cup is an amazing event, and I'm happy to be participating and creating some more awareness. I mean, I was on the Breeders' Cup board for a bunch of years, and I decided to step away from the board so I could just be a little more free in terms of getting the word out there in the best way. You know, talking about things we can do better to create awareness. I talk about the things that are being done really well, and not worry about sort of what the board has to say. And I think that I'm really proud of the Breeders' Cup for committing 3 years to me and my production company Rock Shrimp to create this digital series called All In, as you said. And basically, for the first year, it's seven episodes. They're about 15 to 20 minutes long. And we really give you a sort of behind-the-scenes view of what it takes to get to the Breeders' Cup, and especially the Breeders' Cup Classic. And we just launched a couple of days ago on Facebook Watch. If you go to the Breeders' Cup Facebook page, you'll see it there. And the reaction has been amazing. And most importantly, it's been amazing for people who are not already fans of horse racing. And that's always been my goal and my attempt, is to create awareness to people that aren't already hooked. As you know, once you get a piece or you get a feeling of this business, it's hard to get yourself away from it. It's almost addicting in a way, in the very best way. So we're getting a lot sort of younger people that haven't really participated in the sport before, now starting to pay attention. And I think All In has a lot to do with that.
We're talking to Bobby Flay. It's extremely well said. Bobby, people who know the sport are going to watch that series no matter what. They're going to love it. But what do you want the viewers, especially those who are new to the sport, who maybe were trying to get into the sport, what do you want the viewers to take away from the series?
I want them to see the people behind the sport. A lot of times we focus on the horses themselves who are, you know, amazing athletes. They're beautiful. They don't hang around very long in terms of racing. They have, you know, their careers are, you know, 1, 2, 3 years. And then they almost get forgotten in a way. They're all beautiful. They're mostly all brown and gorgeous. And they're hard to tell apart by the naked eye. But the people behind the horses, the people that own them, the people that train them, the people that breed them, all have amazing stories. They come from all walks of life. And I think that when you watch All In, you'll get you'll become really interested in the people that are really making this business flow and this sport so competitive. You'll see the passion in these people's beings and their voice. And I think that that's what's really the key to All In and getting people more interested in horse racing.
Thursday night is a great night to dip a toe and get started at MyBookie. Remember, who you're betting on is just as important as who you're betting with. This is why I always tell people to bet with my bookie. Trust me, they are the very best bet this season. They have been in business for years, they have great reviews online, and their mobile site is so easy to use. I would only recommend a service to you that I've been using myself. This is why I'm urging you to make your way to my bookie. You win, they pay. They have in-game live betting, the most rewarding player perks in the business, and for you fantasy guys out there, you can even bet the over-under on how many fantasy points a player will score each game. Join right now, and MyBookie will match your deposit dollar for dollar. Use the promo code ROME and activate that offer. Visit MyBookie online today. That's MyBookie. Do not forget to use the promo code ROME when creating your account, and you can claim up to $1,000 in free play. You play, you win, you get paid with MyBookie. Bobby Flay is my guest. He is the EP of All In, The Road to the Classic. It is a 7-part docuseries on Facebook Watch. And Bobby, you're somebody who cares deeply, obviously, about the horses and about the sport. But overall, you've said that the sport right now is at a critical moment. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's at a critical moment because we're in a place where the viewership, the wagering, sort of declines a little bit every single year. And anybody can tell you, you don't have to be an analyst to understand that that's not a good trend. And, you know, the thing that I try to do as a fan of the sport, as an ambassador of the sport, is to, I keep saying the word awareness. We need more awareness. So I'll just give you for instance.
Sure.
I had an idea to create a new race called the Breeders' Cup Derby that got shot down. And I thought it would be a really good way to showcase all the 3-year-olds that were running in all the Triple Crown races through the year, being marketed in the very best way on NBC. And the public at large will actually know those horses' names when we get to the Breeders' Cup and let the 3-year-old division get settled in the Breeders' Cup Derby. It got shot down. The Breeders' Cup did not want to do it. They have a very hard time in going away from tradition, so to speak. But yeah, you have to, as you know, you have to change with the times. Instead, the Breeders' Cup added a race. It's a juvenile filly turf race. It's not going to make anybody take a day off on Friday to watch the Breeders' Cup. I think it's going to be a really good competitive race. But to me, it's about creating awareness for the people that do not know the sport, and that's what All In's about. So hopefully we'll pick some new people up.
We're talking to Bobby Flay. All right, so a big part of the sport, Bobby, of course, is the food and the drink. When people think of Churchill Downs, they think mint juleps, but what do you recommend beverage-wise for the Breeders' Cup at Churchill Downs in the first weekend of November?
Well, if you're going to run a horse race in Kentucky, it has to involve bourbon for sure. I make a drink with bourbon and some lemon juice and some fresh mint. So you kind of get that mint julep thing, but it's not as sweet and it's got a little more citrus flavor for the fall. You could even do it, you know, instead of lemons, you can do some like some oranges. Anything with citrus and bourbon works really well. But I'm actually going to be watching the Breeders' Cup from my living room this year. I'm really looking forward to watching the NBC telecast, which I haven't been able to do live, you know, for probably the last decade. They do an amazing job, and it gives you a great insight to what's about to happen before the races. And so I'm going to have a bunch of people over my house Friday. We're going to order a bunch of stone crabs from Florida and have sort of a stone crab fest in Florida. And then on Saturday, I'm going to cook, you know, classic Kentucky cuisine. You know, some fried chicken, some biscuits, some bourbon cocktails, and we're going to bet some races.
I'm talking about the best invite ever, man. You would be a great guy to be friends with. Imagine being at Bobby Flay's house and having him cooking up food and serving food for the Breeders' Cup. You want to check it all out. It's called All In, The Road to the Classic. It's a 7-part docuseries on Facebook Watch. You know, Bob, you're preaching to the choir. You know, we just have to find a way to get people to the game, because once they get to the game, they love the game. We just have to find a way to get them in the door. That's the big challenge, of course.
No question. I appreciate your camaraderie there.
Did you check the highlights from Steph Curry's monster night? Yeah, well, next time, get a ticket for the real thing from my pals at Vivid Seats. With Vivid Seats, a brand new sponsor here, you can attend the concert, the show, or sporting event of your choice and do so at a great price. Here's what I like about Vivid Seats. It is the top source for tickets for all the live events that you want to go to, and you can sort by price or look for the seats in the section and the row of your choice. And to make it even better, Vivid Seats is reaching out to you new customers and will give you a promo code, which will give you 10% off your first ticket order so you can save even more money. Here's what you do. You go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. First-time customers, make sure you use the promo code ROME and get 10% off your first Vivid Seats order. Every single purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. Make sure you download that app and enter the promo code ROME and get 10% off your first order on Vivid Seats. Make a memory that lasts a lifetime. Let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. Vivid Seats, this is a great company with an awesome proposition. Check it out yourself. Vivid Seats. I want to talk about something that came up on yesterday's program. In fact, kind of been lingering a little bit in the back for the last couple of days, and that's that piece from The Athletic that appears to be challenging the toughness of Raiders quarterback Derek Carr. Some ways into this piece, and it's a piece about the state of the Raiders, they're talking about the fallout from the trades of Khalil Mack and Amari Cooper, and then you come upon this line, and I quote, "Team sources describe a fractured relationship between Carr and his teammates, mostly because confidence in him has waned," end quote. Pretty heavy sentence. Team sources is doing an awful lot of work right here. And I'm not questioning the reporter who wrote that. Not at all. Marcus Thompson is an excellent reporter. And if he's getting somebody to describe the relationship between the star quarterback and his teammates as fractured, every reporter worth his or her salt would write about that. So my issue is not with Thompson. My issue is not with Thompson for citing somebody as a team source. But if you're going to say that the relationship between the star quarterback, who literally has put his body on the line for his team, if you're going to say that that guy's relationship with his teammates is fractured, put your damn name on it. This guy puts his body on the line, so you can put your name on that. Because that sounds an awful lot like somebody in the organization trying to pave the way for trading or running Carr out of town. I mean, no better way to justify trading or cutting your star quarterback and that big price tag that comes along with it than by challenging his ability to lead and questioning his toughness. Because when you challenge somebody's ability to lead and you question their toughness in a game like football, it's nearly impossible to unring that bell. All it takes is the mere suggestion, and then you got a bunch of you clowning Carr. You start making fun of this guy. You start to question his toughness. And I've got a few thoughts on this. Starting with this, do you remember this guy playing against the Panthers with a pinky that looked like it had been nearly ripped off and then reattached at a right angle? He led them to a fourth quarter win in that game, despite the fact that it looked like he put on one of his digits backwards. Remember that game? How about that time when he had his leg snapped by the Colts? He was mic'd up for that.
Hey, man, here we go. Take a deep breath, man. Here we go.
Blue Whitey, what's up? It's broke. It's broke. It's broke. It's broke. It's broke. It's broke.
When was the last time you broke your leg and didn't say anything other than it's broke? It's broke. I mean, that sounds like a guy who's talking about a busted remote, not a busted stick. Except you'd be a hell of a lot more pissed if you had a busted remote than he did a busted leg. And it goes on. This guy's being helped off the field with a broken fibula, and he's encouraging his backup at the same time.
Wow, the crowd chanting for Derek Carr as the MVP. A real moment here.
I love you, bro. Hang it up. I'm going to love you. We got to finish it off, Maddie. I know you do. I know you do.
Right, so the guy breaks his leg, and all he has is it's broke and support for the guy coming in for him. Hey, remember that time Derek Carr broke his back? His back. That happened also. And I don't remember any anonymous sources coming for the guy when that happened. I don't remember anybody accusing him of crying when he busted his back. I mean, I could go on and on about this, but I don't need to. His tight end, Lee Smith, will take it from here.
It's just a ridiculous thing I've heard ever. It's to the point to where it's comical and laughable that I'm even sitting here talking about it. Us as players have zero issue with Derek Carr. He is our leader. He's always been our leader. We put a C on his chest for a reason, along with Rodney Hudson. And regardless of what face he makes after a tackle or what everybody wants to dive into and wear him out about, attacking his character or attacking him as a leader on this football team is a joke. And I hope that everyone hears me loud and clear of what a joke it is. It's frustrating, it's annoying, and it's laughable and not fair to him when it's obviously not coming from inside this locker room. Anybody can say whatever they want. Coach Gruden and Derek are going to take all the bullets. We're 1-5. We're not playing the football we want to play. Coach Gruden had a lot of expectations coming in. We had a lot of expectations coming in. I understand that those two guys take most of the bullets, and those two can definitely handle it. If anybody can handle it, it's Derek Carr, based off of the person he is and the character he has. But to ever insinuate that there's an issue inside this locker room with our leader and our captain is the biggest joke I've ever seen.
I don't think anybody in that locker room could have made that any more clear than he did. For Lee Smith, questioning his quarterback's toughness was a reason to go. Now, that wasn't T.O. crying for his quarterback. That's a tight end saying, let me tell you something, that's our captain. Nobody in this locker room feels that way about him. Nobody here is questioning this guy's toughness at all or his character. I mean, like, when you know what Derek Carr has been through, on the field and off the field, it's impossible to challenge this guy's toughness, question his toughness, his ability to lead. So, to me, if a team source wants to do it, put your name on it. Put your name on it. There may be a time and a place for anonymous sources, but this is not one of those times. And here's the other thing. Derek Carr is not the problem with the Raiders. Far from it. He's not the reason they're a one-win team. He'll tell you he is, but he's not. I mean, sure, he hasn't played at the level that he'd like to play at. But then again, I thought John Gruden was a quarterback whisperer. Wasn't he the guy who had that quarterback camp for all those years? And if John Gruden is so great with quarterbacks, how come the Raider offense is so bad? Because Carr was a three-time Pro Bowler and an MVP candidate playing for guys who aren't John Gruden. And suddenly he's no good under Gruden. Who's that on? Look, there are lots of issues with the Raiders. Derek Carr is not on the short list of their concerns. They've got a lot more pressing concerns, a lot bigger issues. You know, like the fact that guys are questioning the head coach, like the fact that the team is tanking, like the fact that the players don't think that the coach is being sincere or honest with them, like the fact that the best pass rusher was traded away and this team can't get any pass rush whatsoever, like the fact that that team is a dubious officiating call away from being winless, like the fact that that team appears to be getting worse every week and not better, like the fact that the team just went to London, got hammered, and looked ill-prepared. But yeah, let's go ahead and run a misdirection and blame the quarterback and question his toughness and question his relationship with the rest of the locker room. Yeah, I'm sure that's the problem. I'm sure that's the problem. Just like I'm sure that John Gruden's got a plan. It's just not what he said it was. Well, the players don't like being lied to. The players do not like being lied to. They're funny like that. If you're going to question this guy's toughness when he's gone out there with a busted leg, a busted back, a jacked up digit, just put your name to it. That's fine. You're entitled to your opinion. You're in that facility. You would know. Put your name on it. That's dirty. That is dirty. Because I can't think of another reason why you would do that. Why would you do that other than to grease the tracks to set it up so you can run this guy out of town? No better way than to question the quarterback's ability to lead, his toughness, and to say he cried when he got hit. I'm not buying it because I've seen this guy and what he's played through. Thursday's Daily Jungle is repped by Ferguson. Listen to this. No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors with thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game. When the pressure is on, you can count on Ferguson. Mike Budenholzer. Mike, it's nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Jim?
Good, good. Mike, nice to visit with you. You beat Philadelphia last night, 123-108. Another huge game from Giannis. But before we get into that, I want to ask you about that defense. The defense you guys played in the second half, where you held a very good Sixers team, Mike, to just 44 points. How pleased were you with your effort on the defensive side last night?
Yeah, that's what we've been preaching, you know, from first day of camp, first drill, you know, first words out of my mouth, out of our assistant coach's mouth is, you know, we got to be good defensively. And so, you know, to have a second half like that where you, you know, limit them to, you know, 44 points or whatever it was. And, you know, because we weren't very good offensively in the third quarter, but you got to have your D every night, every quarter. And, you know, we feel like we can be good if we do that.
Mike Budenholzer, my guest. And then Mike, Giannis had another amazing night, 34, 18, and 10. That's his fourth straight 25-point, 15-rebound performance to start the year. And to put that in perspective, he's the first player since Wilt Chamberlain to do that. Before you took that job, you had faced Giannis for a number of years. As somebody coaching up against him, what was your perception of him?
Just so amazing as far as getting to the paint, getting to the basket, and playing, you know, in just the smallest spaces. You know, if there was a crack, it was just, you know, amazing how he could get through it and finish, lots of times being fouled and making the bucket and going to the free throw line. And just, you know, how that was the thing that stood out the most. But then, you know, I think his length, his athleticism, you know, he's just the different things he can do. It's like he's, you know, I don't know what position he is. We used to argue in the coaches' meetings, you know, is he the point guard? Is he the power forward? Is he small forward? He's basically everything. And, you know, now it's great that he's on our team.
I mean, that is so absurd, right? Like, what position is he? And then I know it's a small sample. It's only four games, but he's averaging 29 points, 17 boards, 7 assists, and a couple of blocks. It's only four games, but the numbers are so absurd, and he's only 23. How high is his ceiling? How much better can he get?
Yeah, no, I mean, I hesitate to say this because I really believe it's true. I think he can get better. You know, I think there's offensively areas where he's going to grow. We're really, you know, encouraging him to continue to shoot and to be confident. And he's going to be a good shooter. And like, it's going to take him continue to work on it, continue to take game shots. And then, you know, the way he's passing the ball, the way he's playing with his teammates and his court vision and all those things are, you know, I think he's taken big steps forward, but I think there's even more to come. And, you know, defensively, it's you know, he and I visit, and we feel like he can be playing even better. And, you know, everybody for good reason gives him a lot of credit with how he's played, you know, out of the gate. But he's his harshest critic, and, you know, he wants to be great, and he thinks he can be even better. And you know, I hesitate to say this, but I think he can be. And, you know, it's what makes us, you know, so excited. And, you know, I think the guys around him are playing well. And, you know, we just want to keep pushing and trying to get better.
Milwaukee Bucks head coach Mike Budenholzer is my guest. All right, so in terms of the guys around him, let me ask you about Chris Middleton. He's hitting nearly 60% from deep. He's averaging 24 per game. He's doing some really nice work on the defensive end, too. That said, he doesn't get a ton of attention from fans outside of Milwaukee. So what are people missing when they don't pay attention to Middleton?
Yeah, I mean, he's just such a good scorer, just a really poised, like, efficient. You know, I think his efficiency, again, you know, it's like you've mentioned, it's only four games, but the way he's shooting the ball from the three-point line, and, you know, I think on Monday he had 30 points on 14 shots, which is just insane. You know, and so I think his, you know, his willingness and his ability to really kind of become more efficient, you know, as we come out of the gates this year, and he's just a knockdown shooter. And then, you know, when you need a bucket, he can go get you a bucket one-on-one, and then, you know, he hits tough shots. And you know, you need a couple guys on your team that, you know, hopefully we're getting a lot of good open looks. But sometimes, you know, you want to be a good team. You want to win in the playoffs. You want to win in the fourth quarter. You got to have some guys that make tough shots. And, you know, he's one of those guys that can do that.
So, Mike, last night's win over Philadelphia meant that you beat Brett Brown, who is another former member of the Spurs organization. I mean, that's a guy that I've got so much respect for, and I know you do as well. Having said that he deserved to be coach of the year for the last five seasons, do you notice traits in him and his team that maybe you see in yourself and your team that can all be traced back to Pop?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think Brett is such a good friend. I have so much respect for him. And, you know, I couldn't agree more about him being the coach of the year for really all 5 years. And, you know, if he would have gotten it last year, it would have been like a cumulative, you know, effect or whatever. He's phenomenal what he's done. And I think you know, I think the way that they share the ball, the way they move, the unselfishness, and it's, you know, you see the culture, you see the guys enjoying playing with each other, respecting each other, and there's a competitive spirit that you know, Brett no doubt has as he's storming up and down the sidelines and calling timeouts. And you know, we're lucky. We got to learn from the best in Pop and be around great players, you know, and Timmy and Manu and Tony and, you know, going back to David and Sean and Avery and those guys. And so many great players. And, you know, if you're around long enough, if your ears are open, your eyes are open, you know, you'll pick some of it up. And when you get your chance, you got a head start.
You know, Mike, the thing that blows me away is that so much of this traces back to, of all places, Pomona Pitzer. It just blows me away. You know, but even before that, you're from Arizona, and your father, Vince, was a legendary high school coach who was inducted into the Arizona Coaches Association Hall of Fame. So what was it like growing up as his son and learning from him?
Yeah, you went deep. It was great. I mean, I'm so lucky to have a father who was a basketball coach. And I mean, I remember going to his practices. I remember him on the sidelines. You know, he was intense. And you know, I think he gave me a great passion for the sport, a great passion for coaching. And, you know, he's sitting there diagramming on his, you know, with old magnets. Like, you know, I haven't seen a magnet board, but I have visions of my dad, you know, drawing up plays or not drawing them up. You know, you move the magnet with a 1 and a 2 and a 3 and a 4 and a 5. And, you know, all that stuff. It's a big part of who I am. And, you know, he's incredibly proud and watches every game and gives me texts and ideas. And, you know, I'm lucky in many, many ways, and for sure one of them is having a dad who was a high school basketball coach.
We're talking to Mike Budenholzer for a few more moments. Also, that goes back to Pomona again. I'm blown away by that, as I mentioned. It's just not that big of a place, nor is it the kind of place where I would expect legendary basketball coaches to come from. But you played your college ball there. You played college golf at Pomona. How did you get from Arizona to Pomona? And aside from your dad, what about your brothers? What kind of a role did they play in that?
Yeah, no, I was, you know, our family was fortunate. I had two older brothers that went to Pomona and played football there. And, you know, I'm the youngest. And so they, you know, I think give me some guidance and let me know, you know, what a great education it was, what a great opportunity it would be if I could get in. And thankfully, somehow I was accepted. And Pop was the coach there then. And so, you know, he had recruited me. I didn't actually play for him because he left that summer, but, you know, little did I know I'd worked for him for, you know, almost 20 years and, you know, have incredible success. And, you know, he'd give me, you know, kick me out the door eventually and onto my own team. But, yeah, it all goes back to Pomona, which is wild. Pop and I, you know, laugh sometimes. We're just a couple of Division III guys. Like, what the hell are we doing in the NBA? But it's been fun, and, you know, we're gonna keep pushing it.
Mike, one more thought then. So you go to Europe and you play basketball and you start coaching. When did you first start thinking that you want to spend your life in basketball in some way, shape, or form? Or maybe was that always the plan?
Yeah, no, I always wanted to be a coach. You know, it's just, whatever, you know, when you're a kid and, you know, people are trying to ask you or figure out what you're going to do. I knew I wanted to coach. I really wanted to be a college basketball coach. It was my dream. You know, be a Division I coach or Division II, Division III. I wanted to be a college basketball coach and was doing everything I could to try and become one, and kind of, you know, lucked on or stumbled onto the NBA, and Pop brought me to San Antonio as a video guy, and I never left the NBA, and I love it. I'm incredibly fortunate. But the dream really for me was to be a college coach.
So what was that gig like? Video coordinator for the Spurs when he brought you back and that was your first opportunity. What was that gig like?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, you talk about a place to learn. And, you know, now across the league, the guys that started there, you know, the Eric Spoelstras, you know, the Frank Vogels, the Mike Browns, Fizz, you know, all over the league, there's guys that just, you know, have started in the video room. You learn so much. Your eyes get trained to watch, you know, all 10 guys, the whole court, spacing, execution, attention to detail. You know, you're on the hot spot. There's a lot of pressure. You know, if anything goes wrong, you know, you're hearing about it, and so it's an incredible place to learn and prepare. And, you know, if you're lucky, then you get to become an assistant and, you know, hopefully keep moving up the ladder.
And then, Mike, finally, I would imagine, I'm going to really put myself out there, I would imagine you're not all that surprised to see the kind of success that Steve Kerr is having as a head coach.
No. I mean, incredible. Just incredible human being. You know, I was really fortunate to be around him as a player, and then, you know, I've got, you know, stayed close with him as, you know, he finished and GM in Phoenix and now coaching. he's just an incredible human being. Got great feel for people. He's competitive. You know, got great vision for how the sport should be played, offensively, defensively. He's just, he's one of the best. I mean, and no doubt they have great players, but I don't think it can be, you know, should not be underestimated how good a coach Steve is, and he deserves a ton of credit.
And, Mike, one last thought about that before I let you go. Just having great players, you can't win without great players, but having great players does not mean it's an easy job, right? I mean, these are great guys, but that does not mean that's an easy gig, is it?
No, I mean, I think it really, you know, I don't know. It's not fair when some people make that statement, you know, he's got the best player, so of course he's going to win. It's just, it's so not true, you know. And when you reach a certain level, when you reach the conference finals, you reach the NBA finals, well, everybody has good players. You know, both teams have, you know, great rosters and usually superstars and a collection of players. And so, you know, when you got to be that final team standing and, you know, everything's got to be pulled together and there's moments when the team's got to be pulled together, you got to put something in place. And, you know, what the great coaches have done over the years, you know, whether it's, you know, the Phil Jacksons, the Greg Popoviches, Steve Kerr now, and, you know, Chuck Daly's and all those. Yes, they do have great players, but I don't think anybody should underestimate the kind of coaching that they've given those great players and helped push them to be, you know, champions.
Mike, I keep trying to cut you loose, but you keep saying really interesting things. Chuck Daly, that's a guy who gets lost in the shuffle, right? How good of a coach was Chuck Daly, and what was he like with the Dream Team?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think he was amazing, and what he did with those Detroit teams and his style. And, you know, this is more, you know, kind of legend for me. It was when I first came in the league, but, you know, his ability to know when to ignore a player or not listen to a player and get, you know, that team of that collection of just personalities and craziness. And, I mean, they were phenomenal. They were so good. And the way he handled them and coached them, you know, I think there's a lot of coaches that have learned from him. And, you know, you got to pick your spots, I think, when you're in the NBA and you're working with, you know, these elite players and personalities. And I think, you know, he's one of the guys that did it, you know, as good or better than anybody.
Mike, are you kidding me about those personalities? Can you imagine that team? Dennis Rodman, Mahorn, Laimbeer, Isaiah Thomas. Are you kidding me to manage all those personalities?
It's a little different than the Spurs, you know, kind of roadmap or whatever. So, but it's just proof, you know, there's lots of different ways to win and there's lots of different types of players that can come together and be champions. And so, yeah, no, that was a little different.
Another angle to the World Series. One word you've probably heard 1,000 times already and we'll probably hear 1,000 times more even before the World Series is over, even if it's a short World Series. Matchups. Matchups. Because now more than ever, baseball is played less between the lines and more between the margins. That's the game in 2018. Guys are playing multiple positions. Outfielders pull out cheat sheets from their back pocket so they know where to position themselves and how to shift for every single hitter. Skippers have multiple lineups for every kind of pitcher that they're going to face. There has never been more information readily available, and there's never been more teams putting all that intel into action. But for all the matchups to watch in this series, probably none are more interesting and fierce than the matchup between Red Sox second baseman Brock Holt and the American drive-through staple Taco Bell. Yes, it's a real thing. Yes, it has gotten ugly. Yes, it's getting messy. If you watch Game 1 Tuesday night, then you probably know that Taco Bell was running their famous promotion, steal a bag, steal a taco. And it's exactly what it's advertised to be. If any player from either team rips a bag in the World Series, then Taco Bell is on the hook for one free taco to anybody who hits them up on November 1st. I'm sure T-Bell was probably looking for a little more mileage from this than Mookie Betts ending it as quickly as he did because he stole second base two batters into Game 1.
Did you know with your stolen base, the whole country gets a free taco?
I did. That's for everybody. Make sure you go get you a taco.
Quote, that's for everybody. Make sure you go get yourself a taco. Oh, he knew. He knew. Turns out, though, it's not for everybody. He said, quote, that's for everybody. Go get yourself a taco. Apparently, though, it's not. Not only is it not for everybody, it's not for one of his teammates. Brock Holt, who became a legend when he hit for the first ever postseason cycle in baseball history, then became public enemy number one when he dropped a nuke on the Bell. Holt said, and I quote, "I haven't eaten Taco Bell in probably 10 years. I'll probably stay away from the free taco. I'll let everyone else get it. I'm going to stay away from Taco Bell. You'll end up on the toilet all night." End quote. I think that I speak for nearly every American, Brock, when I ask, and? What's your point, Brock? There's so many amazing quotes, or there's so many amazing things about that quote. The first being the fact that Taco Bell is a major sponsor of the World Series, and Brock Holt is out there blowing them up for blowing him up. Obviously, this guy is speaking from personal experience. You don't make a point. You don't swerve that far out of your lane to say you haven't done that in 10 years, unless he's speaking from personal experience. And obviously, he was not too happy. He wasn't too happy with that experience if 10 years later he's still talking about it. How bad must that guy's not have been 10 years ago if it's still fresh enough on his mind to bring it up a decade after the blowout? My guess is Taco Bell did not scratch a check to Major League Baseball thinking they were going to get that kind of reaction from that promotion, thinking that they would have somebody talking about getting the runs when somebody ripped that bag. That's not a baseball pun, getting the runs. That's a diarrhea pun, just so we're clear. But again, that's not my take. That's Brock Holt's take. Brock's take on Taco Bell made the rounds, and he was asked about it before Game 2 yesterday. And I got to respect the fact that my man was not coming off that take. My man was not backing down from what he said. In fact, he was all in.
Brock, have you heard, whether through social media or in any other way, from anyone at Taco Bell today? And what would it take for you to give their product another try?
Oh, man. I don't think I'll be trying Taco Bell. I'm sorry, Taco Bell. I mean, that's just my opinion. I'm sure a lot of other people love it. I deleted Twitter. I'm sure if I had Twitter, I would hear something, but I deleted Twitter last year, so I don't know if Taco Bell has an Instagram, but they haven't messaged me or tagged me anything, so I apologize to Taco Bell. I'm sure a lot of people will get their free tacos, though.
In other words, sorry. Sorry. Sorry, not sorry. Sorry for not giving your laxative taco another try, T-Bell. That's what the guy's saying. Probably smart to be off of Twitter right now, Brock, because the Bell is pretty damn beloved in this country. And it rakes $2 billion a year on those tacos that they're slinging out of the back windows of like 7,000 worldwide locations. Personally, I do not have a dog in this fight because I'm kind of about the Bell, in fact. I'm about the Bell in the fact you can order like 20 items and get changed on a $10 bill. So you're not going to catch me going in on them, but he's entitled to his own opinion. And if that's the experience he had with them, then I'm not going to challenge him for that. But I will say this. I am about one thing. I'm all about takes and not backing down from takes. And if you're going to say Taco Bell put you on the porcelain for an hour or two or more 10 years ago, then you cannot walk that take back the very next day. And he didn't, which I respect. Like I said, this is a matchup. If you want to talk about the analytics, if you want to talk sabermetrics, you want to talk about matchups, here is a matchup you want to watch for: Brock Holt versus Taco Bell. In his mind, America versus their toilets. Free food versus bubble guts. I'm not picking a side. I'm not picking a side. I'm going to enjoy the battle. Free takes, free tacos. Win-win. Howard Beck joining us. Howard, that's a famous story that you point out, that Michael Jordan punched Steve Kerr in the face. I mean, look, I understand how these things happen, I guess, in practice. They're going at it. Mike was intense. But of all guys, Steve Kerr? What would you have given to be there to see that?
Man, and I think it was at a practice too, so that would have been close to the media. I don't think that one is on film anywhere, and that was in a long before the iPhone era. So sadly, we do not have footage of that. I'm sure Steve Kerr is grateful for that and would probably want to smack me for saying, sadly, we don't have footage.
Howard Beck joining us. He'd understand. We all have a job to do. Lakers beat the Suns last night, Howard. So that's their first win of the season. What would you have told folks, though, who were panicking after the Lakers started 0-3?
I mean, you know me, Jim. I'm Mr. Nuance. Play it down the middle. You know, it's too early. Let's not panic. Let's not get crazy. But even for me, I thought that losing last night would have been pretty serious. It's not that they'd be 0-4. It's that they'd be 0-4 going into a back-to-back game against Denver tonight, a game that they're expected to lose, and then a game at San Antonio on Saturday. You know, 0-3 is one thing, but 0-6 would have been something else entirely. And, you know, LeBron has said it. We've all said it. I've certainly highlighted this angle since the moment he got there. It's going to take time. It's basically a brand new team. And it's a you know, a bunch of veterans coming in, grafted onto this young core that hadn't won anything yet. And no one should be expecting that this team is going to look like a playoff team overnight. Like, it just takes time. You can't speed that up. And by the way, we now have a shorter than ever preseason. So they didn't even have that much time to get together, figure out their chemistry and the way they want to play in a rotation, because there aren't that many preseason games anymore. So we should give this team some time to develop organically. And the pressure cooker of LA and the expectations that always go with that team, and especially the expectations that always fall on, is going to make it an unfair prism that they're going to be viewed through. But, you know, that's the reality of it. And LeBron knows that better than anybody.
Howard Beck is joining us. He is a senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. Howard, you have had a very interesting piece, I thought, on Kyrie Irving and his world. Now, one of the things that comes across in that piece is that Kyrie is a different dude, very, very different. How would you describe him, and what makes him different from just about anybody else in that league?
Thank you for mentioning the story. I mean, I think Kyrie's very frustrating in that regard. He is very different. He doesn't just march to his own drummer. I think that he may be the only person who can hear that drummer. it's not just the flat earth stuff, you know, deciding to create that Uncle Drew character and then having the audacity to say, like, I can make a movie about this and I can act. And he was, by the way, he was good. Like, he was really good. Like, Shaq in that movie was just Shaq acting like an old Shaq. Kyrie Irving was a different person. Like, he was really interesting to see. So he has this artistic side. He has this, I think, an intellectual curiosity, and people can scoff at that if they want because of the flat earth stuff that he flirted around with. But I think that was also just part of him feeling like, well, why shouldn't we just say what if about everything? Well, shouldn't we consider this for a minute? And where is the proof? And how do we know? You know, there's a certain aspect of that isn't wrong. It's okay to wonder and to probe and to want to see proof of things. Like, that's fine. It's how far you take it. And I think the flat earth thing, I think that one just got away from him. I think at one point he was just like messing with everybody, and then he doubled down on it because he saw a reaction. But he, to me, the off court stuff where he just doesn't see, you know, barriers or sees the world differently, it applies directly to on the court, where the plays that he can make, the places he can get on the court, the things that he can pull off, I think are rooted in this same kind of just belief that I don't see the barriers that everybody else sees. I kind of just pick my own path, and I believe that path is there.
Howard Beck, my guest. Howard, one more thought about that before you go. What's your sense then of the relationship that he had with LeBron, and how does he view their time together?
I think that the relationship with LeBron varied. I don't think it was ever as bad as people might think it was. I don't think it was ever great either. I think there was always a little bit of a tension there, a little bit similar to the Shaq and Kobe dynamic in L.A. back in the day. And I think that Kyrie, in his best moments, appreciates a lot of what he learned from LeBron in terms of how to be a leader. And I think that Kyrie's actually been a pretty good leader in Boston with a younger team in a way that he never would have been able to be in Cleveland with a veteran team and a team that was centered around LeBron. So I think he would credit him with teaching him a lot of valuable lessons about leading in the NBA.
All right, so Boston's 2-2, and for all the attention that the Western Conference gets, is Boston the biggest threat to Golden State this year, or is it somebody else?
I think it's Boston, and I know the slow start undermines that a little bit right now, but again, it's really early. The Celtics just have such incredible talent and depth. And it's not just, oh, they have three all-stars and you know, a couple of younger guys who could become all-stars. It's that they're strong, like, 1 through 8, 1 through 9. And it's the kind of players they have, Jim. It's the fact that when you have Gordon Hayward and Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, throw Marcus Morris into the mix, you've just got a bunch of guys who can switch every defensive assignment. And what we saw with the Rockets last spring was, if you just switch everything, you can get the Warriors to kind of stall out and play iso ball and, you know, play into all their worst habits and lose their identity. And that happened to the Warriors in that series. And the Rockets did it with much less across-the-board talent. Yes, supreme talent with Harden and Chris Paul, but not all these interchangeable long 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", guys who can switch everything defensively. The Celtics have not just talent, but the kind of personnel that I think is built to fluster the Warriors. I'm not going to say beat, but at least challenge the Warriors.
He is a senior NBA writer at Bleacher Report, the host of the Full 48 podcast, and a UC Davis Aggie. Howard Beck, my guest. Howard, so good to have you back. Really appreciate it. Have a great day, Howard.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thank you. Go Aggs.
Huntington Beach, Silk Bra. Hey, Bra, what's up?
Hey, Jimmy. How you doing, buddy?
Great,
hey,
Silk.
Knock, knock.
All right, I'll play along. Who's there, Bra?
Owen.
Owen who, Silk?
The Dodgers are 0-2. Come on.
That's the big Silk. All right.
No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Hey, look, once in a while you might deke me. That guy will never deke me. I always know it's not him. Come on. A knock-knock joke. Rex in Albuquerque. Not really sure why he's calling. Hey, Rex, what's up?
Hey, Romy. You know, there aren't many things that get my knickers in a knot, but disrespecting Taco Bell is one of them. Mookie Betts steals a base, delivering free Doritos Locos Tacos to America, and Brock Holt takes a pass saying you'll end up on the toilet all night. Really, Brock? Why did you do the bell like that, Brock? That's the unwritten agreement. Stop acting like you're too good for delicious powdered meat that leads to explosive rhea. Or eating a 99-cent double-decker that leads to taking a 99-minute double-decker.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Hey, Rex, I don't like that call. Rex, I hate that call. Let's go to Long Beach. Ira in the LBC. Ira, what's up? How are you?
Oh, I'm over fine, Romy. Just when, Lord, when does it ever end? It's just like perpetuated beyond my wildest nightmares.
You,
but Romy,
tell me.
This is a great time of year, man. Even though the Dodgers are down a couple games, you know, they're running into a buzzsaw, definitely. I mean, the Red Sox are pretty damn good, so... we've got three coming up at home. We got the Breeders' Cup coming up. Romy, what I wanted to talk about was clones. Check this out, all right? You know, when Romy talks about, you know, giving horse racing a chance, one of my proudest things, Romy, ever, is the only – I don't know if you remember this or not. Tell me if you do. The only time you ever called me on my phone number, out of the blue, I pick up the phone. Hey, is Ira there? I'm like, yeah, who's this? It's all, hey, Ira, what's up? It's Romy. I'm like, what the hell? What are you calling me for? And you said, dude, I've never smoked crack, but horse racing must be like crack because I cannot get enough. And I just wanted to tell you that when Janet suggested that we maybe invest in some horse flesh, that the deciding factor in that was me knowing that you enjoyed horse racing and that if I enjoyed it, it must have some element of fun to it. So you green-lighted that. The rest is history. And misdirection might have been one of your proudest moments, Romy, but I never saw you happier than when Shared Belief took the Santa Anita handicap. The smile on your face that day, dude, was just huge, huge, huge. And also, yeah, people, I do know how long to cook a hot dog over an open flame of a garbage
can. How long,
yeah,
Ray? How long?
Oh, probably about 3.5 minutes,
okay,
I would imagine.
That's what I thought. Let me jump in. I got to jump in, Ira. Sorry about this, bro. When you start that phone call by saying, Clones, clones, clones. When does it all end? When does it all end? Irie, I can answer that. When you find a place to live. Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, John.
This ain't John. This Oscar, baby. And I'm pissed off. You want to know why, bro?
Why, John?
Because I'm fat and I'm hungry and I want my taco.
Run me.
That's not a good call.
Did he jump in with rack me?
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
Run me. Run me. Gladly. Run me. Gladly. Run me. Absolutely.
Good night.